get started. It's my pleasure to welcome and introduce Norm Martin, visiting us from CETA. Norm did his PhD in plasma physics. I just learned. I was a bit surprised by the title of his PhD. But then he went on to do astrophysics, which is almost the same as plasma physics. And I was trying to figure out what his most influential work is, but apparently he's very influential in very different areas of astrophysics, except for cosmology, which is going to be very influential from now on. Other than that, he's the director of CETA. He's won several awards, Miller Visiting Professorship, Canada Researcher, Premier Research Excellence Award, etc. And today he's going to tell us about how you can look for non-dark matter in cosmological observations.
Right, thanks for inviting me to speak. Excuse me. I want to talk about some work which is very new to me, and you'll see this in the talk. It's not exactly going to be a polished talk. I don't feel as comfortable saying that I know what I'm talking about, but it's okay. You guys can ask me questions, and if I get something wrong, you'll tell me. The title is obviously a little funny. The point is, right, I show you a picture here of luminous matter. This is Andromeda, one of the nearby guys. And it was from looking at objects like this, galaxies, or in particular the 21 centimeter mission from objects like this, that we really had the first solid clue that there was something other than just, you know, ordinary matter out there. And then in the 70s, Vera Rubin in particular convinced astronomers, I think, that there was such a thing as dark matter. It had been suggested before by Fritz Zwicky, but I don't think with very compelling. Fritz Zwicky got everything he did right to zeroth order, but usually on data that was just, you know, if you look at it, there's no reason why he should have got it right, except that obviously he's a smart guy. I want to talk about looking for baryonic matter, but that isn't bright. That's the point, right? So it is dark in a way, but it's not what people think of as dark matter. And the reason, well, I'll explain why the reason is, okay. So here's sort of an outline of the talk I want to just sort of point out to you, which probably most of you do since you're here at Perimeter. You believe in dark matter. People are looking for this in labs. They're looking for it in decay products. Cosmologists really convinced everybody that it was dark matter from WMAP and things like that. But so people are sure it's out there and they're looking for it. As I said earlier, you can look and see that there is luminous matter. But if you believe the cosmologists from cosmological observations, we can infer the total amount of both baryonic and dark matter in the universe. They're both minor constituents. The biggest component is dark energy, which is something we really don't understand. But if you look around galaxies and say, okay, you know, we don't know how much dark matter is in a galaxy, where are the baryons? They don't add up, right? So this just raises the question, does, you know, lambda CDM, which is the sort of generic model nowadays of how structure forms, does it really work? You know, because it naively would tell you that the baryons just follow the dark matter. If the dark matter falls into a halo, or, you know, a gravitationally bound object, the gas ought to fall with it, so it ought to be in the halo. And yet, if you look, you have a hard time seeing it. Okay, I will show you quickly a few simulations about what we think is going on. And recently, the argument is that a lot of the matter that falls in the galaxy halos does go into the very bottom of the halo, down where the galaxy is, but then it gets thrown back out. Brian here is a big advocate of this, so you can ask him about that. Then I'll talk a little bit about directly observations of both dark and baryonic matter, and then talk about using a new technique. It's not particularly new, but cross correlations between lensing maps, which tell you where the total amount of matter is in a region on the sky, and other tracers of baryonic matter, particularly the Sanyag-Zeldovich maps or Compton-White maps. Okay, and I'll just point out that this actually can lead to cosmologically relevant constraints on cosmological parameters, in particular sigma 8, but also on omega m. Okay, so that's the outline of the talk. I thought I'd put up an old paper talking about cold dark matter. It's sort of interesting. This is from 1985. I don't know if you can see that up there. There it is right up there. This is a Nature letter from a bunch of people that were at Berkeley, and then a little later they started doing simulations. So it says here, popular theory for galaxy formation holds that the universe is dominated by exotic particles such as axions, photinos, or gravitinos, collectively known as cold dark matter. Okay. So then they did a simulation to see what things look like. And then they say down here, and this is the part I kind of like, I'll read it real quick. The morphology of most galaxies can be represented as a superposition of a rotationally supported disk in an ellipsoidal stellar system. The Hubble sequence classifies galaxies according to the relative importance of these components. Spiral bulges and faint ellipticals show substantial rotation, but most bright ellipticals rotate slowly. All these things are facts today, which is kind of amazing, because a lot of facts turn out not to be facts, but these are still facts, okay? Further, ellipticals are found preferentially in regions of high galaxy density, whereas spirals avoid such regions. And they go on to talk about some other things. And they say, these systematic properties of galaxies and the associated characteristic scales are the least that any theory of galaxy formation should explain, okay? So that's sort of, you know, like, if you're going to be able to do anything, you should be able to explain these things. And the point is, some of these things were explained by lambda CDM calculations, but a lot of them were definitely not. Okay, and that's the point. So there's some, you know, they're doing okay, but we I should say, people that model galaxy formation are doing okay, but we still need to do better. Like, one of the things is, you know, do you predict the right number of stars in a galaxy? And the answer is, until the last year or two, no. Right? We didn't, by factors of like 5, which is not, you know, in astronomy, you can almost notice factors of 5, right? Anyway, so I want to talk about how people do these things and what's going on.
Get the ratio of bulge to disk rate and things like that.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. So, no, there's a lot of things we don't get correct. Yeah.
The trends that they just mentioned in that paragraph, are those all explained? Or?
I would say no. Yeah, not really yet. The point is, we don't have a good cosmological simulation that resolves the relevant physical processes in galaxy scales yet. I will show you simulations where we claim to be getting the small scale physics, right? But those are in simulations that zoom in on individual halos. You cannot do this yet for a whole cosmological box. So there are these recent, very impressive illustrious simulations, which is a really big box. They definitely don't get, they try to put in by hand, enforce the stellar mass halo mass relationship by fiddling with the star formation. And they still don't get it right, okay? And it's not like they're incompetent. These are the best people in the business. It's just hard, okay? All right, so the one thing I do like about this problem is that it is nowadays really, it is a physics problem, right? In a physics problem, right, you start off with a set of initial conditions, well-defined, everybody knows what they are, and then you write down a set of equations, you know, dynamical equations, basically F equals ma to zeroth order, and then you just solve the damn things, right? That's a physics problem. Now, the difficulty is that, you know, when you're an undergraduate, people give you physics problems that you think are hard, but they're solvable, right? There's an answer. You can just write down an analytic solution, typically. Most problems aren't like that, right? You write down some simple toy problem, and it's nonlinear, and there is no analytic solution, okay? Well, then you say, okay, fine, you just put it on a computer and solve it that way. And even that's not trivial, and that's what's going on here. Here, we know the initial conditions. There they are, right? I like this picture because it tells you, you know, what's the distribution of density and temperature of the baryons on the sky at some high redshift. And it's incredibly linear, right? I mean, the fluctuations here are, you know, like sort of a part in 100,000. That's very linear, all right? And then to zeroth order, you just have to put in gravity and go, okay? And that's what people were doing in that paper earlier, the Nature paper. That kind of problem we can actually solve on a computer now. But unfortunately, if you just do it that way, with dark matter only and gravity, you get all these wrong answers, okay? So now the question is, well, anyway, let me continue. That's the initial conditions. From that map, right, which is kind of pretty, but, you know, what is it actually telling you? You make power spectra like this, and you see as a function of essentially spatial scale, right? Small scales over here, big scales over there. What's the amount of, how big are the fluctuations, okay? And these various bumps and wiggles are just telling you how the universe, the gas in the universe was ringing as it entered into the horizon, okay? And from this, you can measure things like the total dark matter abundance in the universe, the total baryonic abundance, and so forth, okay? So that tells you what the dark matter fraction of the total matter of the universe is, what the baryonic fraction is. So we know the initial conditions in terms of fluctuations in the density and the temperature early on, and we also know that the actual constituents, what they're, we don't know what they are, but we know how much mass or energy density there is in each of the constituents, okay? And for that, you know, you've got, as I say, a pretty good initial condition problem. All right, so here's a little bit of earlier evidence I mentioned for dark matter. This is from Vera Rubin in 1980. And these are rotation curves of 21-centimeter emission from neutral hydrogen in galaxies. And the point is, this, for example, this one's this distance scale is kiloparsecs. H was still 50 at the time. This goes out to 60 or 80 kiloparsecs. And of course, the galaxy's down here inside of 10 kiloparsecs. But the rotation velocity was pretty flat in all these systems, out to large scales where there weren't any stars at all. So that was the evidence that for dark matter. Alternately, you can say we don't understand how gravity works. That's the alternate interpretation, okay? Another picture of dark matter. This is the dark matter on somewhat larger scales around galaxies. These are images on the left of these two columns of lensed galaxies. There's a galaxy in the center here, and then around it you can see these sort of ring-like features. And those are lensed galaxies in the background, and you can use this to measure. So here's, you remove the light from the galaxy, and there's the background imaged source. Okay, and there's an almost complete Einstein ring here and here. So given this, you can measure the amount of dark matter inside a given radius of the source, the host lens galaxy. And again, that tells you that there's a lot more matter in there than you see in the visible light from the stars. Okay, so there is dark matter in the universe. We know how much it is. And we know that it piles up in, you know, virialized regions that galaxies happen to be sitting in. Okay? All right. So, as I have already mentioned, you can just do brute force and ignorance. This is the way to solve a lot of problems, right? Put it on a computer and go. And this is from that 1985 Nature paper I was showing you earlier. And, you know, that might look familiar to some of the members in the audience, even though they've never seen this picture. But if you look today, there's the same thing today, okay, with a bigger computer. It looks prettier. On the right is just dark matter. On the left, it's the same thing, the same simulation. They just painted on where they think the galaxies ought
just
to be.
They added color now, right?
Yes, they added color. That's more or less what they did. They just painted little specks differently, right? Okay, following some rules, okay, right? So there's little numbers in the little places where you put different colors, right?
They didn't have Photoshop.
Right. The boxes are a little bigger and there's more particles. Okay. But it's the same general story as it was, what is that, 30 years ago now, 1985.
Same people.
Some of the same people. Indeed. Yes. All right. Fine. All right. So now I want to go and talk about, you know, the baryonic matter. So the first thing I wanted to point out, of course, is that stars are pretty easy to see. That's why we know about them. I spelled that wrong, but they only form in halos, I was supposed to say here. And I would claim they only form in disks, although Brian is telling me otherwise. And they don't account for much of, if you look inside a given halo where you think you know the halo mass, say from a lensing measurement, for example, the stars account for less than a quarter, even in the most, you know, efficient star-forming galaxies, less than a quarter of the total budget of baryons that ought to be in a dark matter halo of a given mass. And in many galaxies, it's a much smaller fraction. So stars don't actually, you know, you add up all the stars, that doesn't even account for the baryonic matter, never mind the dark matter. Okay?
So you're talking about just the host halo or the whole universe? Because I think it's less than
25%. Now I'm cutting down to the whole, just to the individual host.
Individual.
Yeah, exactly. If you look in the universe as a whole, depends on what redshift you look at. If you look locally, you don't see a lot of baryons. If you look at higher redshift, if you look in the Lyman Alpha Forest,
what fraction of matter is in the stars? I think it's the percent or so. I don't remember.
Well, this is about right. The total mass in the energy density sense in stars is a very tiny fraction. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of galaxies that don't reach this percentage. This is just the peak of this. This is like the L star galaxies where you make stars very efficiently. So there's other forms of gas or baryons in the universe, so just hydrogen. But it turns out locally, at low redshift, that's a really small fraction of the baryons in a halo, okay? This isn't so true if you look at higher redshift. At higher redshift, you know, you can have like half of the, you can have as much gas in stars as in gas as you have in stars. But you don't see that locally. In local systems, If you go in the Milky Way, for example, we think there's about 10 to the 10 solar masses of gas that we can see. And there's about 5 times that much in stars. And that's inside the halo. That's all the gas in the halo. There's presumably X-ray emitting, you know, 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6K gas, but we can't see it. That's the point, right? And whether it adds up to all the baryons, that's a question. All right.
By the way, you were going to say on the last slide something about a high redshift when you look at baryon alpha forests. You see what fraction of the baryons?
You see a substantial fraction of the baryons in the, if you add up all the hydrogen in the Lyman alpha forest. Yeah.
You're talking about, I mean.
That's not necessarily in halos, of course. You're not quite sure. Well, some of it's in halos and some isn't.
No, but the universe is mostly ionized, so I think you do assume some
ionization fraction. You try to calculate the ionization fraction. You have to make assumptions, yeah. But, you know, we do make assumptions that are reliable in real life every day, and they're okay. The ionization corrections are, you know, the atomic physics, that we understand pretty well. You have to understand the background radiation field.
Yeah. Well, that's
and that's reasonably well constrained, I would say. Okay. All right. So you can see neutral hydrogen. These are just from the Thing survey. This is nearby galaxies. And the H1 disks are much larger, bigger in extent than the stellar disks. But the total amount of mass, again, is typically no bigger than the star stellar mass, and often less. Okay. There's also molecular gas way down deep in the disks. But again, in the local universe, it's typically a small fraction of the stellar mass. Okay. So in other words, if you add up all the baryons, you don't see what you ought to see. So this plot's supposed to say that. So there's two different ones. The top one here is from Dai et al. This was up here are, so this is circular velocity along this axis up to 1,000 kilometers a second. And then this is the baryon fraction. And the cosmic abundance is around 0.17 or something like that. And so that's this dotted line across the top. So if a halo has all its baryons, the points ought to be up here. And if you look in, you know, things like this, very massive clusters, in fact, you do see almost all the baryons. Okay, maybe it's 90%, maybe it's 85, maybe it's, you know, people argue a little bit, but basically they're all there. Okay, but if you look at lower mass things, so what these guys were doing is they were stacking. They went and looked in two mass, saw small groups, and then stacked. They had a lot of groups. They stacked X-ray images of those groups and saw detected X-rays from the stack, and that's what these big circles are. And their claim is that as you go to lower mass groups, you know, things with circular velocities of several hundred kilometers a second, in fact, you know, a lot of the baryons aren't in the X-ray emitting gas. This is the form of gas that you might have thought was surrounding the Milky Way, you know, 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6K gas, it's hard to see. But in a bigger cluster, temperature is a little higher, densities are maybe a little higher, you can see it in emission. In fact, you do see it in emission, that's what these points are. Okay? But if you go farther down, these are estimates from various places about what the total abundance, adding up stars, gas, everything you can think of. So if you go down to like the Milky Way, 220 or whatever, you know, we've got maybe a little more than a quarter of our baryons. So where's the rest of the baryons? And if you go to these low mass guys, it claims you have even less. Okay. Here's another plot showing the same sort of thing. This is again versus circular velocity. This is the fraction of baryons in a halo, which relative to the cosmic abundance. And it's so these guys are claiming at 10 to the 15 solar masses that you only have like 85% of the baryons, but I'm not going to worry about that. Down here, they claim is you have very, very few, right? At L star, maybe a quarter of the baryons, okay? And this is the stellar mass. As I was saying, at L star here, you know, sort of 10 to 12 solar masses of halo and 10 to the few by 10 to 10 of stars. The peak efficiency of star formation, they are claiming it gets up to like 35%. Okay. All right. So lots about missing baryons. Let's see, how am I doing? Good. And as I said, this really is a sort of a low Z problem only at some level. Okay, so now I want to sort of shift gears and talk about, you know, why might star formation not be very efficient? And then potentially why are the baryons not so obvious in the halos? Okay.
Can I push you a little bit on that? So you're saying at high Z you look at Lyman alpha forest and you see all the baryons, but what you really see is the neutral column.
Yes.
And then you assume.
Then you do some ionization correction, and then you say you get close. Yeah.
Is that a good assumption that the ionization recombination equilibrium?
No, not in every. No. If you go to low enough columns, yes, that's right. You could be out of photoionization equilibrium, so then you have to try to think about. Yeah,
so,
no thanks.
So I guess it's not so clear that the virus, if it becomes a virus.
I wouldn't disagree with that statement. I'm just saying that it's not so obvious that it's a problem. Okay, whereas at low redshift, it really is pretty hard to find the things. I agree with you, it might be that not all the baryons are visible at high redshift either. But
they are not visible. It's like 10 to the minus 4 of them that are visible. Just you have to do this model, right?
Right. Well, but so currently, I think people are claiming that a lot of the baryons that should be in halos are actually there. So I won't mention this, but there's been recent work where people doing the COS surveys, cosmic origin spectrograph, looking at baryons in nearby halos of nearby galaxies. And the claim is that actually most of the baryons are actually out in the halo. They're just in gas that's at a temperature of around a little above 10 to the 5. And the tracer there is oxygen 6.
But that's the same.
It's the same problem. You have to do an ionization correction. That's correct.
And metallicity,
Well, no, there you can actually try because you can see more than one ion. And you can actually, in some cases, see more than one ionization state, and then you can get a pretty good handle then on the ionization state of the gas. So those measurements are more believable because there's better constraints.
Yeah. And the UV background is sufficient to keep that stuff hot?
No. That's an opportunity.
can you get enough information by comparing a different redshift and just see the history?
Yes, I think that would be a good goal. It's not been done systematically. So again, that's also an opportunity. That's a lot of observations and it's collating a lot of information. It's a non-trivial process. Yeah. But Brian's question is a good one. Why oxygen 6 ought not to be anywhere, right? What's that? Yeah, exactly, right. So that's a big clue. That's telling you something. All right, stellar feedback. So this is to talk about why is it that, naively when people did this back in the 70s, they thought gas would cool, fall down in the center of the halo, make a bunch of stars, what's the problem? They should all be there, and whatever gas is around. And it's not, okay, so why not? And I think there's a pretty compelling argument now that it's due to stellar feedback in the cases of most, L-star galaxies. All right, so I want to just explain what that is. Okay, so here's a picture of stellar feedback in action. I don't know if you can see right there, there's a little star cluster. It's got about 20 or 30 O-stars in it. And it's in a pretty good, moderately big molecular cloud. This is in the Milky Way. This is a Spitzer image. I'm very proud I actually made this image myself. I'm a theorist, right? But I made this image. This is 8-micron emission, the sort of orange stuff, and you can actually see the individual stars in the cluster there, and of course there are HST images of this, which are gorgeous. You can also see this in free, which is how I first found it. I was looking at WMAP, and WMAP detected this source. Okay, cosmologists didn't know this, but it did. And you can use WMAP to estimate the total mass in O stars, and it turns out to be that you ought to have about 20 O stars here, and then you go look at HST, and by God, there's 20 O stars there, right? So that's pretty good. But what I thought was interesting when I looked in Spitzer is like every time I saw a free emitting region, free comes from massive stars, very young massive stars, things that are say 30, 40, 50 solar masses. They're hot enough that they produce photons that have energies above 13.6 eV, right? So they ionize the gas, heats it up, gets hot, but then you get recombination. So you see H-alpha emission. But in addition, because it's hot gas, it's 10 to 4K, you see free emission from the electrons. Okay, so that's how I found it in WMAP. So every time I looked at one of these things, I saw this. There was clearly a bubble, this region that's been evacuated around the O stars. Okay, now these things weren't seen because there's still a lot of obscuration. This is a Spitzer image at 8.
And where is the O-star? Where are the O-star?
I'll get the hockey stick.
The bubble is on the side. Is that centered around?
Nope, it's not centered. Oh. And this is a pretty young. So there are the stars right there. That was a known H2 region, meaning HII region, ionized hydrogen emitting. But actually, the free emission isn't coming from right there. The free emission is coming from all this stuff around here. Okay. So most of the emission is not from the classical H2 regions. Now this region is, I forget, it's not very big. It's about maybe 10 parsecs across, so it's pretty small and it's pretty young. Okay. If you wait later, you look at more or bigger clusters, they tend to be more centered. But typically, younger clusters are definitely not centered in the regions that are evacuated around them. Okay. So what's going on, of course, is that these things used to be a region where it was the highest density anywhere in the region, right? That's why they're making stars there. The stars form, it's like, who was the guy, Dillon? Dillinger? Why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. Well, why do stars form there? It's where the gas is, okay? No, they don't move. They mind their own business and stay where they are. They just push everybody else around, right?
But then why did they push it one way?
Well, because it wasn't sitting dead center in a spherically symmetric distribution of gas, right?
Some lower density.
Exactly. You know, you push away the stuff that's easy to push away. Yeah. And so that was, I'm spending a lot of time on microphysics here, okay, but people are asking questions, so I may as well. The reason, you can actually tell that because you can measure the velocities of this using either CO or the traces of molecules. And they're, the velocities on one side or the other are different by about plus or minus 10 kilometers a second. Okay, which is typically the expansion velocity you expect from an H2. This is a Strongman sphere for the students, right? Although, as you notice, it's not a sphere centered around the stars, so Strongman didn't get that part right. Okay, but okay, it's a Strongman sphere. And it's expanding at about 10 kilometers a second. Okay, so it's not just that the cavity was there to begin with. It is being made by the stars, but it's pushing, it's expanding fastest in the regions where the density is lowest, as Mike was saying. Okay, let me move along here. So I got to put this in because it's an old movie, but this is from my student Libby Harper Clark, who did a really good job and then decided that she'd had enough of astrophysics and has gone on to become a teacher in England. So let me just play the movie. So on the left, I played this, I think, here at Perimeter once before, but is density. This is our toy model of a star forming region. So there's high temperature, low density gas with in pressure equilibrium with low temperature, high density gas. And this is the fraction of ionized gas to begin with. There's no ionization. And what's going to happen is we've stirred this gas up turbulently. Of course, it's kind of silly. It's a smooth density distribution, which isn't what it really looks like, but fine. It's a theorist version of a turbulent cloud. And what's going to happen is the cloud's going to collapse and start making stars, and they're going to start disrupting the cloud. Okay. Okay, so I stopped it there. You saw what happened. The turbulence has pushed the gas around, and it's made the red here is higher density. It's made these ridges of, they're really sheets of where shocks have formed when two bits of gas have come together. And then they start feeling the effects of self-gravity, and they start making stars. So you probably can't see from the back, but there's this little black dot right there, which is where the star cluster formed. And just like in that image I showed you, the star cluster's here, which is not in the center of the region where it's expanding. And here's H2 fraction is high here. To the southwest, this would be in an astronomical image, right? And the reason is, of course, because this thing's forming in a ridge of gas, but not dead center in the ridge, okay? And it goes off and then does funny things. You can see that, right, that this is periodic boundary conditions, so the gas that's emitted wraps around the other side, which it shouldn't do, but okay, all right? So the idea is that this feedback here, this is, we stopped it before any supernova went off, which is important. This takes less than about 1 million years to happen. If you wait full 4 million years and don't have any feedback, you turn more than half of this gas into stars. But because you have early forms of feedback, they disrupt the cloud. The forms of feedback that were put in the simulation were radiation pressure on dust grains and heating from the ionization. So you can see the temperature got really high there, up to 10,000 K. Which just causes the gas to be overpressured and expand. And then, and those were the only two forms of feedback in this particular run. And they disrupt the cloud pretty effectively, okay?
So are you assuming that they all form IMF stars? Or do you?
We put in an IMF, the standard IMF.
So most of the stars haven't formed?
Oh, no, they have. Even the low mass stars form in a hurry. Well, in simulations, they just do it because you could argue the simulations are wrong. But there's actually the way they form on a free fall time in the gas. They really do. There's a lore.
So you're just saying it's an overdensity. It hasn't these things yet. Okay, fine.
It's an overdensity. The free fall time of the density is very short. The stuff forms. Boom.
Eventually, it's going to be a low mass star.
Oh, there's plenty of low mass stars in there at the same time. They're forming at the same time the high mass stars do. They're just a little late and not in the center of the infalling flow.
I'm just saying their collapse times are much longer than the
sure. The collapse times are much shorter than.
No.
Oh, you mean the cloud?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it can take.
The collapse times of these clouds are. No, their collapse times are typically 4 or 5 or maybe 10 million years for GMCs in the Milky Way. But that's longer than it takes the stars to form by quite a bit. So, I mean, you actually know this, right? O stars are 40 solar masses. We see them all the time. They're all over the place. They live 4 million years.
Yeah,
but I'm saying they form in less than 4 million years because they only live 4 million years. Okay. And in fact, they form in about 100,000 years, it turns out, almost certainly. Okay. And the little stars are doing their best to keep up, but of course they don't. So that's why they're little. Right? All right, so if you put that kind of physics into galactic scale simulations, okay, with good spatial resolution, it turns out you can actually make simulations. So the first thing we did was just isolated galaxies. This is with Phil Hopkins and Elliot Quatere. You see two things happen. One, the global star formation rate is much slower by a factor of 100 than the free fall time of the gas as a whole. This is what Brian was asking about. In any individual dense clump, the star formation rate is just basically the free fall time, the gas divided by the free fall time. Okay, but globally, it regulates itself, the disk, to form only about 2% of the mass to convert it into stars. Okay, and the reason is the feedback that I was showing you there. Right, I showed you that star cluster disrupted the GMC. Most of the mass in the GMC never turned into stars. Okay, and then after the simulation I showed you, supernovas start going off, and they just really stir up the surrounding gas, and they keep it in a highly turbulent state where it isn't self-gravitating. And self-gravitating gas, obviously, doesn't form stars. Okay? And that's what these simulations demonstrated. So these are just a number of images. These are just, you know, mock GRI. You do a galaxy simulation. You put in this microphysics I was telling you about. You make a bunch of stars, and then you just use a radiative transfer code after the fact to say what they look like. So that's what those two images are. That's face on and edge on. And this is gas. And this is from the same sorts of simulations. Now, this one here, there's a ring of star formation there. And you can maybe see in the back, there's these red things going out. You can't tell if they're going in or out in here, but if you watch a movie, they're going out. And what's going on there is that's the second effect that you see. And that's primarily due to the supernova, which is that these star clusters that form here, each individual star cluster will drive a gas out of the galaxy. And if you add them all together, you get a galactic scale wind. Okay? So these simulations were just individual isolated galaxies that we started with some initial conditions and ran them for, you know, a giga year or so. And what you see is you get the star formation rate that you follows the relationships that you see in observations, the Kennicott-Schmidt law for the people who know about these things. And you see gas being driven out of the galaxy. And the mass that's being driven out of the galaxy per unit time is comparable to or larger than the star formation rate. Okay? So that's a way of getting gas out of galaxies and not turning it into stars, which will give you the low fraction of baryonic mass in stars. Okay, not in these simulations, but it would lead to that.
Does it escape or does it come back?
You can't tell from these simulations. So I'll come on to that, yeah.
So you said you convert 2% of the mass into stars?
Per free fall time, per galaxy free fall or rotation time.
Okay, but then there are many free fall times, so you could get much more.
Yes. You don't have all that many. Typically, right, the dynamical time scale where we are is what is it, 20, 30 million years. Okay. So, yeah, if you go to 3 giga years, that's 100 dynamical times. So you could imagine you could get rid of the gas, but barely. But then in the meantime, you know, we know there's other gas around falling in.
Right.
Right.
So I'm just saying, you can't make it to 25%.
Yeah, you have enough time to make it 25%. Right. But unless... So to go back to Mike's question, unless you actually really get the gas out of the galaxy for a long time, it doesn't matter if you try to slow it down, unless you really get the gas to stay away for a long time, it's going to fall back in, it's going to make, you know, you're going to make more gas than disk.
Get to the angular momentum.
Say again?
How do you get to the angular momentum?
Ah, well, so this is an interesting question. If you take the angular momentum that you start with and have stuff fall in, you'll get galaxies that are too big. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the problems with early simulations where people did put in baryons and didn't have the feedback properly. You had a lot of low density gas come into the center, so you had things that had too high of circular velocities in the center, but you also had star formation at, you know, really large radii. Okay, so you need to get rid of gas in the middle, which has low angular momentum. And you want to prevent gas at large radii from making stars.
And then like GMC by GMC basis, do you need to have like MRI or some sort of transport?
Yes. So the answer is, observationally, GMCs have very little specific angular momentum, much less than the gas that they formed out of from the disk. So something is removing angular momentum from individual GMCs. The easy thing to say is this magnetic field. It's not MRI, it's the same reason like the sun is spinning slowly. These simulations, the small scale ones I was showing you did, I'm not sure if that specific run I showed you did. We had both ones with and without magnetic fields. Didn't make a big difference in the star formation.
I always thought that one of the things we were taught at graduate school is that angular momentum is a problem for forming a star, but you need to get rid of it. And presumably the way to do it is magnetic field. But if you don't have magnetic field, then I don't see how
when you form stars, what you really say is I have an overdensity above some scale, right? I mean, you don't actually watch the formation of a protostar or anything like that. So the angular momentum problem.
Actually, nowadays people actually do watch the formation of.
Yeah, but that requires.
That requires
magnetic field.
No, that doesn't. You can make stars, they're a little too big and too puffy, without MHD, okay? And people do this in AMR simulations where they have 30 or so, 35 levels of
what mediates angular momentum transport?
Remember, it's a turbulent flow. So there's always some gas that has very little angular momentum. And it's that gas that'll make the star. So you'll get a star formation rate, which is maybe not quite right to begin with, okay? But at the end of the day,
are you sure it's not numerical viscosity that's mediating angular momentum transport?
So this is a good question. AMR codes have trouble with that.
Yeah.
Right? So
I don't believe we're getting zero angular momentum gas. I mean, small, yes, but stars are very small.
So you can do it both ways. So I'm trying to remember the guy's name at Princeton. He's a really good postdoc there. He's doing runs with MHD and, in fact, modified MHD. Because if you use MHD, so again, he's done these simulations where he's got 30 levels of resolution, very high spatial resolution. He actually sees the first core form and the second core. And if you use ideal MHD, you form disks, but the disks you form are too puffy because there's too much magnetic field in them. Okay, so it's actually the opposite problem. You need to have non-ideal MHD effects, which he's done, which allow the magnetic field to escape away, and then you get a Keplerian disk, because you do see Keplerian disks around protostars. And if you have MHD, you don't get Keplerian disks. Okay. So, but on the other hand, if you run the same simulations without any magnetic fields, you still make stars. You still have stuff falling in because you get enough exchange of angular momentum, possibly from the code, not from real life, to form stars.
These things also form jets, and so you can lose some of that.
The jets form spontaneously in these simulations.
Yes.
You see them.
Oh
yeah. Oh yeah, they're MHD simulations. The MHD simulations make jets.
That
can take away a fair amount of angular momentum. But Avery's asking another question. How about in the runs where you don't have MHD? You still see stars forming.
But do you need MHD to get jets?
You do not see you do not see jets forming in runs that don't have MHD.
It just depends on what you put in there.
Sure.
In this other case, when you see star formation without MHD, it's not
right.
Clear to me you have your viscosity under control. So you see something. But it's not clear that you have any physical idea of what that is.
Well, that's true of most simulations.
Well, no, absolutely. But at least if I have MHD turbulence, I have a story with angular momentum transport. I can check the magnitude.
Yes,
this brings up a more general question. In this ENSO simulation that you showed, you set up what looked like a nice smooth pressure support.
It was. I said that. Yes.
With a random velocity field.
Well, we put it on a forcing, which generated a random.
Oh, yeah. Right. Were you driving turbulence?
We did both kinds of runs, where we drove it continuously and where we didn't. It didn't make any difference.
Okay. Yeah. So I know I've seen a lot of these simulations where, like you said, on a free fall time scale, everything makes stars, but I agree with Brian. I don't think that's what the universe looks like. We don't see that, right?
So no, you do see that. I think that's incorrect. You do see that.
Okay.
You do see that.
That's not a good conversation for lunch, but yeah.
Yes. So I still have 15 minutes. Okay. We'll eventually get to the cross-correlation. All right, anyway, so yeah, I'll go a little faster here through this. Oh, I gotta show the movie still. So these are now, these are what I said at the beginning, these fire simulations, which is just some acronym stands for feedback in realistic environments. Anyway, it's pretty cool. So you can see what's going on. This is a cosmological simulation. Now, using the same sorts of feedback that I described earlier on small scales, and these are quite high resolution. You know, several parsec scale resolution in a box that's about a megaparsec on a side, okay? And so these are two runs, one, as it says, with no feedback at all, and one with feedback, okay? And it's basically a temperature. The color maps to the temperature. So on the left, even with no feedback, you can see you get some high temperature gas out here. But it's much higher temperature, and there's much more gas at large radii away from the galaxy when you have feedback. And the forms of feedback are radiation pressure, H2 gas pressure, supernovae, photoelectric heating, all the sort of, you know, mundane things that you think of in the ISM. There is no AGN feedback in this at all. Okay. And this is the reason I put this movie in was not just because it's a cool movie, but to show you that, you know, in your simulation box, you can see hot gas, you know its density, and you can just see it, okay? And you can see that it's different over here than it is over here. The feedback has done something. It's pushed a lot of hot gas out of the galaxy. So you could try to find this stuff in X-ray emission, but I've already showed you that plot that says it's hard to do. You have to stack lots of galaxies, and they've got to be not galaxies, but groups to see it. The other way you could see this is just if you had a probe of the pressure here, the temperature times the density, all right? And the reason I say that is because X-ray emission goes like n squared, but if you're just calculating the pressure, that goes just proportional to the number density. And we have a tool like that called the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. Okay, so the idea is to use the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect to probe to see if you can see this gas and tell whether the real universe looks more like this or more like that. Okay.
Is the color about the same in both directions?
Yes. All right, so I do want to say a few words about AGN feedback, because in fact, in the data I'm going to show you later, it's probably mostly due to, it's not clear to me what it's due to, but AGN feedback probably has played a role. And the simulations I've showed you up to now don't have any AGN in them. So here's a picture of one of Annie Fabian's favorite objects. It's from a paper of his. This is Perseus, I think, is that this, yeah. Some nearby cluster. And the idea is this is some unsharp mask or whatever the words are. Trying to show you that there's variations in the density of the plasma around the cluster. And this is supposed to be evidence of feedback. It's evacuated regions where you've dumped in a lot of energy and heated the gas up and produced these bubbles. And I've written down various forms of feedback. You know, there are radio jets. You see broad absorption line winds or very high velocity outflows. You see radiative heating. You know, you just have X-rays from AGN, there's radiation pressure. All these things can produce, you know, forces on gas that eject them from big clusters. Okay. So we do have one or two simulations, not the fire simulations yet, but these are earlier ones from Phil Hopkins where we put an AGN in a galaxy. Very high resolution again. Subparsec scale resolution in the simulations. We zoomed in on the inner part. And here's a run with no black hole in the center. And here's one with a black hole. And the idea is the feedback that we put in was just the broad absorption line wind. So we actually resolve the gas till it gets down onto the AGN disk, meaning where it's supported by its own thermal gas pressure. So it's a Shakira-Sunyaev disk. And then we say it just falls onto the hole after that. And then that tells us what the luminosity is from the hole. And we use that to calculate the mass and velocity from a BAL wind. Okay, and then we put that wind back into the simulation. And it blows this hole, in the center part of the galaxy. But remember, this is only 10 parsec scaled, okay? And it also blows out of the disk of the galaxy, all right? So that is AGN feedback on very small scales. Now, this still hasn't answered the question that Mike was asking, does this gas get out of the galaxy or not? In the fire simulations, I should have said, we do see that you get gas that actually leaves the halo, but not a large fraction. Maybe 10 or 20%. So if you believe our simulations, which Avery won't and the rest of you shouldn't, okay, it's possible to actually drive gas out of L-star halos just using stellar feedback. We don't have an answer yet for the AGN feedback. because you can't run that kind of high resolution in a full-size halo. It's just the dynamic range isn't there yet. Okay. All right, now there's real AGN feedback, we think. This is a picture from one of Brian's, this is the annual reviews article, actually. And the red stuff is radio emission, so you're supposed to think of a jet, maybe somebody who got bent a little bit. And the blue is X-ray emission. Okay, so both of these could be due to feedback. The radio jet is feedback, and the X-ray gas, you know, you heat X-ray gas falling into a cluster, but you also heat it up from feedback. All right. So can we detect those baryons? And I said the ones in and around halos. Okay. So I sort of mentioned this already, so maybe I better skip ahead. I have 10 minutes still, I'm all right. And I shouldn't go all the way. I should leave a few minutes for we've had some discussion, but but people get pissed off if you keep them after lunch, through lunch, yes, right?
They open mind.
Yeah, okay. All right, let me go through it pretty quickly, though. So you can look for emission. As I said, that's proportional to the number density squared. So you tend to see stuff more in the centers of the halos. It's hardest to see stuff farther away. You win a little bit, you know, the emission measure, there's a volume there, but it's still easier to see stuff. And you do see it, as I said, in massive clusters. You can also look for Sanyavs-Eldovich, except I think I spelled it wrong, and that should just be proportional to the number density. So that's a little easier to see in lower density gas. Okay, so that sort of, there's other ways of doing this, but these are two ways to try to do it. All right, so as I said, that is X-ray emission. So we actually see hot baryons in, this is a big cluster. How big is this guy, 10 to the 15?
Close,
yeah. So big clusters, you can see the gas, okay? And basically, as I said, all the baryons are there. All right. So that was X-ray emission. This is Sanyavs-Eldovich effect, okay? So just real quick, the idea here is it's basically Compton scattering. You've got microwave background photons coming through at a few Kelvin. They pass through a plasma in your halo of a galaxy or a cluster, and that plasma has a temperature which is well above 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, whatever K, and so it's going to heat the photons up. Okay, so that alters the spectrum of the photons a little bit, and you can detect that alteration in the spectrum. Right, if you're below a certain frequency, you see a little bit of a deficit because the photons got pushed up to higher frequency. And if you look at the higher frequency, you see the extra photons that got boosted. And so you can just see the Compton scattering in the map. So these are maps, and there are some point sources in there. But this is a map basically of the whole sky. And that tells you, you know, where the hot electrons are. Okay. So this is from one of the Planck papers. There's a gazillion of them. But I thought this was kind of cool. This is just taking their sources of stacks of Sanyavs-Eldovich map, and they're stacked on what they call the locally brightest galaxy, which I hadn't seen that term before. So they just find something they think is in the center of a halo, and they stack on those locations. So these are different mass bins. You can probably barely read this here. This is 11.55. In the stellar mass, and then it goes down in small bins down to 11.05 down there. And the idea is here, you say, okay, if you stack on galaxies, that looks to me like, yeah, there's a good signal there, right, all the way down here. Maybe down in there you still believe it. Here you're starting to wonder, right, there's all these other sources around. Okay, but clearly they are detecting at the locations of what are basically sort of L-star-type galaxies. Well, a little bigger than L-star, I should say. That is stellar mass or halo mass? That's stellar mass. So they're pretty big galaxies. But you can see definitely there's a Sanyavs-Eldovich signal there. Okay. So this is a cross correlation between stellar mass and hot gas mass. That's what stacking does for you, right?
It's hot gas pressure.
Hot gas pressure. Yes. It's the pressure. The integrated line of sight pressure. Right. Okay, so the question we're sort of addressing now is, do baryons trace dark matter? Okay. So eventually what I got involved with was cross-correlating Sanyavs-Eldovich maps, not with stars, because that's visible matter, but with lensing maps, because that's supposedly a trace of the dark matter. Okay. And it came about because I was looking for missing baryons, and I went to Ludo van Wijnberg and said, look, these guys died all, which I showed you, had stacked on top of you know, two mass groups. They took ROSAT, and they just stacked ROSAT images in the same place, and they saw this signal. Okay, so you've got a lensing map. Why don't you just stack, you know, X-ray images on top of your lensing map? So he did that, and he got a 3-sigma detection, actually. But he said that wasn't, you know, it's not very convincing. As I said to Brian earlier, right, if you're a physicist, you know that half of all 3-sigma results are wrong. So let's see if we can do better. So he had the bright idea of, well, look, why don't we try doing a cross-correlation, not a stack, but a cross-correlation with a Compton Y-map. So that's what Ludo and Gary did. Oh, this is just showing the dark matter lensing again. So here's his map. This is Ludo's map from the CFHT lensing legacy survey. And you can see it's a fairly big part of the sky. This is not the whole thing, but it's some reasonable fraction. And the idea was to just take this image and then take a map of this from the Planck map that I showed you earlier and just cross-correlate them and see whether you saw excess Y in these. So the contours are just the mass measured from the lensing, and these white spots are predictions from the galaxies where the peaks ought to be, roughly. All right? So we did that, did a cross-correlation. So ours is on the right here, and it's showing, it's kind of a little small to see, but this is as a function. He did this in configuration space, and being a good observer, he uses R radius and arc minutes. Okay. Okay, fine. And the idea was, so these are all the same thing. These different plots are different versions of the Planck maps. Okay, because really, this is what cosmologists do, right? They dig around in the dirt. They're, you know, signal the noise of less than one. And then they claim to get a signal out of this by looking at large areas of the sky. And you know, Avery's skeptical about people doing simulations, but, you know, people doing observations in the cosmology game are digging around in the noise just as much, if not more.
I'm an equal opportunity skeptic.
Yeah, okay.
Those are funky error bars.
They're correlated error bars, first of all, yeah. Right, well, so this is part of the problem, right? It's an art, how you extract signals from these maps. Okay, and it's not an art I know much about, so I don't want to say much about it. I'm sure I'm saying things that are wrong already, but if I start talking about this, I'll definitely say things that are wrong. Okay, but the idea was that, you know, on scales of 10 or 20 arc minutes, it was pretty clear we were getting a detection of a cross correlation. That the red ones are supposed to be a test, and they should be clustered around zero. And so the idea is, if there's a separation between the red points and the black points, then you've got a signal. And the claim here is that this is a 6-sigma signal. Okay. Now, his lensing map was CFHT, and he was picking out particular kinds of galaxies. Still have a couple minutes here. And the lensing kernel, meaning where you get most of the lensing effect, was at a fairly low redshift. And so we didn't have to worry too much about one of the main contaminants here, which is the cosmic infrared background. It confuses the Sinyavs-Aldovich people, right? So if you're pick galaxies at low redshift, most of the cosmic background won't be lensed. Cosmic infrared background won't be lensed. Okay. On the left, I'm showing a plot from Hill and Spergel, a paper that came out at about the same time, also claiming a detection of a cross correlation between a lensing map and Sinyavs-Aldovich map. But their lensing map was based on the Planck lensing. So Planck gives you both a Y map and they also give you a lensing map. You can detect the lensing from galaxies and groups in the foreground and clusters, all the matter in the foreground acting on the cosmic microwave background. So they did a cross correlation between those two maps and also claimed to get a six sigma detection. They had the added trouble that, you know, because their lensing kernel went to much higher redshift, because obviously the source is at redshift of 1100 or whatever it is, that they had to worry more about the cosmic infrared background. So that's their post-CIB subtraction here. That's what that means. Okay. So this is saying that, yeah, the pressure tracks the dark matter on scales of, you know, sort of 10 megaparsecs, if you can see that label there, something like that. So this was these were the first two detections of this cross-correlation. Okay, and then the question is next, okay, how do you interpret this? What are you actually seeing? All right. So this is from a paper that came out subsequently by Nick Battaglia and Colin Hill, and I'm on this paper as well. And so we're trying to sort out, we're using Nick's simulations, which do have AGN feedback in them. They don't have any of the stellar feedback I was talking about. They're very big cosmological box simulations. And, you know, we can do simulations with no radiative cooling, okay? That's the sort of blue ones here. We can do simulations with radiative cooling. Sorry, the no radiative coolings are the green, the radiative cooling are the blue. And then we can put in AGN feedback. And you can see, you know, they make noticeable differences in the power and the cross-correlation. This is now done as a function of in K space or L space. Okay, so the point of this slide is just to tell you that you can actually trace the feedback physics from the observations, okay? And then
before you go there,
yeah.
Supposing you kind of know what, you can guess what the electron density might be, so you can make a rough guess at the temperature, I guess, right?
Yes.
Just from the previous
correlation. So right.
What does it work out to be?
I know this number, but I don't remember it at the moment. It's
point something KeV.
It's, I was going to say, it's a little less than a KeV, right? But I refer you to the papers, because I'm not going to remember it exactly. Yeah. So this has become now a bit of an industry. So as I said, here's the paper led by Nick. But then Ludo has also been doing the same thing, pursuing these ideas. So there's now a number of papers in the literature. So one of the things I just want to point out here is that we sort of get a slightly different result than they do, but the zeroth order is the same. And what we've done here is we're varying the cosmology, okay? So in the top plot on the right is a WMAP cosmology, in the bottom it's Planck. And then in this plot, which is sort of the equivalent of that one, the two dotted lines are a Planck cosmology, and there's the WMAP cosmology, okay? And here's the cross-correlation signal that we see, and we meaning Van Werbecke et al. On the left there, it's the CMB lensing one. And that's the Van Werbecke et al. Result is this red dotted line. And you can see here that WMAP seems to explain the observations a bit better than the Planck cosmology does. So the point is that you're trying to here start to test, you know, the cosmological parameters. I wouldn't say that, you know, this is a very good test at the moment, but it will develop into one, I think, over time. Okay, so a detection is nice. What can we do with it? So this is this future work. Cross-correlation amplitude scales like sigma to a high power. So the idea is you can use this to, and also the omega matter, but you can use this to constrain sigma 8. I think that's one of the really interesting things that will eventually come out of this. Okay, you can learn about the cluster physics. So cosmologists don't really care about this, but Brian does. You can maybe locate the missing baryons. Okay, so I think that's where this subject's going to go. So I've taken up more than enough of your time. Thanks a lot for listening.
Coming in spite of the interruptions. Any questions? Actually, before I take questions, so we can have lunch afterwards, but then we also have taking them to dinner at around 6 in the bistro, so we're all welcome to join. So, questions for Tom?
Yeah.
Mike?
But most of the, coming back to the first part, most of the gas doesn't escape, or maybe most of it goes to large distances, but eventually falls back.
That and seems to be what we're seeing.
Again, a source for making future stars.
Yes.
So what's the easy answer to why the overall efficiency is so low? Is it just inefficient per cycle, and there are just so many?
Yes,
so
because by the time you get out to the halo, out of the outer edge of the halo, and a fair fraction of the gas does, actually. Not a lot of it, but a fair fraction. The fallback time is several gigayears, right? If not that. And then, of course, you know, you fall back in, you're going to do the same thing again. So yes, it's if you wait long enough, because the gas isn't getting out of the halo, it will all turn into stars. Yeah. But that's going to be many, many Hubble times. So that's the point. If you believe these simulations. So I should say, right, you can actually test this. You can look for where's the gas in the halo. We sort of had this discussion briefly. So there's recent HST spectroscopic surveys of nearby galaxies where people claim to detect a lot of baryons out in the halo.
In oxygen 6.
Oxygen 6?
SM6.
And you also see some, so that's high ionization or whatever you want to call it, gas, which is very hard to understand because, as Brian said, it cools like crazy. It should not be there, but it's there. Okay. And the atomic physics is right. It is cooling. You see, in some cases, you can, well, I don't think anybody's seen it in emission yet, but it is cooling. And there's no doubt in my mind.
But how can you convert that to baryons? Because you said it doesn't depend on metallicity.
No, it does depend on metallicity, but you can measure the metallicity because you see many, many ions. Right, in the same sight line. So you can calculate the ionization state of the gas. Okay. Now, it's uncertain, right? So there's a good paper by, I know Jason Prochaska's on, I forget who the first, oh, it's Jessica Work, a couple of papers by Jessica Work, which you should probably look at. They make a pretty compelling argument. I can believe they've got their, you know, they've got an uncertainty maybe of a factor of 3. They would claim smaller than that. So maybe it's only half the baryons out there instead of all of them, but okay. Yeah. I should say there's a big reservoir also in cooler gas. It's like magnesium 2 absorbers, so 10 to the 4K gas. That's much more, I mean, everybody's happy with that because that's where it ought to be. Mm-hmm. It's just the other half of the gas that they find is at temperatures where it should not be.
Other questions?
So can you tell if this stuff is in hydrostatic equilibrium with these things?
It's definitely not. Oh, well, most of the gas. The hot gas probably is, I don't know. But the stuff at, you know, 10 to the 4K certainly isn't.
No, I'm talking about the stuff you detect, which is the hotter stuff. Because you've got a pressure.
I would say from the observations at the moment, you couldn't say for sure yes. It's plausible that it is, though. Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, even with this cool stuff that you're seeing in lines which with a very short cooling time, that's consistent with the notion that this stuff is just being churned up.
That
so yes. You're seeing something in a very transient state, and it's just being replenished.
What I would say, it's not transient, it's a dynamic equilibrium, right? There's always winds coming
sure,
out,
yeah.
And it's always flowing back in.
Any atom is only transient.
Yes, there. Right. They're just passing through.
They're
right.
Just passing through, yes.
Right.
Going back to the SZ measurement, I assume that the results are not just due to the known hot gas in clusters. Right? You could work out how much of that
yes.
signal is coming
that,
from
well,
rich clusters that are then
so,
associated with lensing and generating some SZ.
So what I would say is go read Battaglia et al. and Ali Reza's paper. And they kind of like to claim that it's not all not just consistent with the hot gas that you see in the halos. And we're saying that it could well be consistent with just the hot gas. So it's sort of at the stage where you can't tell at the moment, right?
So how would you tell it and get better data? Which is usually the answer to most questions in this room.
With this technique, it's going to be get better data, right? But we will get better data. That is going to happen, okay? The lensing surveys are going to get much bigger and better. That'll make a big difference. So that's going to definitely get better.
And you want to go to lower masses because that's where it's most interesting.
Well, the map that we've got, right, is everything that's in the picture there, and it's not
yeah.
just it's way bigger than a cluster, so it's got everything.
All the rich clusters from another source, like a deep X-ray survey, which I think there is one in that. You could actually cut them out.
You could cut them out.
See what's left. Right.
So this you could certainly do, and that wouldn't take any more new observations. That's correct.
Yeah, there's the XMM LSS or whatever.
Yes. Is it in the LSC? Okay, well, so that
you wouldn't feel that you showed the picture of, but it's not in the whole CFA.
Right. Okay, but well, so there's a good project. I think. Right. I think you're right. You could try to do better with the observations that we've done. Right. I mean, this is not like something that we thought of beforehand. This is just like, oh, why don't we try this? And it looked like, oh, kind of works. Yeah.
Well, sounds cool. That's a new project for us. We could work on this evening. Okay, that's thanks, Norm again.